All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to season two of From the Vault, a true crime podcast. I'm Jason Futch, and thank you all for joining us on another episode of From the Vault as we kick off season two with some great information for just this episode alone. Lots of news, lots of updates that are going to be happening throughout season two, and we're going to also kind of give you guys a preview of what's to come this season. So joining me is my partner in crime, as always, Mr. Nick Wagler, the Cheesehead. What's going on, my friend?
Oh, not a whole lot. Just, you know, settling into my new place. Thankfully, have a much better Wi-Fi connection than previous episodes. So I'm hoping that, you know, we're going to have a smooth recording session today.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be great.
Yeah. And it's wonderful to be back behind the mic again after so long. And 2021's been a rough year, but not as rough as 2020. So I'm thankful for that. So
hey, always. Yeah. Like, I mean, I got to say, it feels great being back behind the microphone. And it's kind of like, I'll put it this way. It's kind of like having a new girlfriend. There's like, it's like a fresh feeling, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just amazing to be able to talk again, to be able to communicate with our fans out there, our listeners. And yeah, like it's just amazing. And I've really missed chatting with you, Nick.
Yeah, it's, you know, it feels like it's been forever, but, you know, now that we're chatting again, it just feels like it's, you know, back to old times, even though it's been, you know, a few months now.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll kind of explain why we took a few months off, and we'll also explain why we're now in season two suddenly. I know we were kind of waiting until we completed a couple episodes before we moved on to season two, but because of the extended hiatus we took, we've just decided to go ahead and label this season two. I mean, we're off to a fresh new start, and we closed off the season one with Henry County John Doe out of Knightstown, Indiana, and it was an update episode more or less because we had already done an episode on Henry County John Doe in season one of True Cold Case Files when Daisy Chains was my co-host. And that was a very interesting case because you have a Hispanic man behind an abandoned gas station and, like, no one knows who this kid is. What we released in that updated episode was that this guy had a receipt in his pocket. And that, this was never before released information until this episode came out, because I had got some inside information from somebody who works for the Henry County Sheriff's Office. This kid that they found behind the abandoned gas station had a receipt from the Reynoldsburg Walmart that they had linked him to. And guess what that purchase was? It was a pregnancy test. So that is like one of the most shocking revelations of that case. Are you by chance familiar with that case, Nick?
I am. I do, you know, other than, you know, the fact that you guys covered this in the past, I do remember reading about him. He's got a very memorable reconstruction, I think, just, you know, from the Nick Meck rendering. He's got this very kind of innocent look, you know, like he's just this, you know, this everyday guy that you would, you know, see in public. And it was just really sad just that nobody had any idea who he was and he was young. It's something that I have read into. I think I've even updated his Doe Network page a few times over the years. But I guess I don't know. I didn't know as much about the case as you have. So this is definitely really important news to hear for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's probably one of the most important bits of information in this case because, you know, now we're thinking, you know, before this could have been gang related, it could have been just a random, you know, murder. But now that this pregnancy test just happens to be in this man's pocket, now that kind of adds a new level in this case, because now you could, I guess, say this could have been an angry father who found out that his son just knocked up this woman and he didn't like it, kills him. Or this could have been an angry boyfriend, and this guy that was murdered was probably this the guy that his girlfriend was sleeping around with. I mean, there's so many theories in that case, and I don't want to get too deep in this because we've got a lot of stuff to cover, but I was glad that, you know, despite the fact that we already kind of had the ending of season one planned out, I was able to at least provide some important information about that case to close out that season.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, hopefully this is going to be, you know, with this information being public now, I mean, hopefully this will inspire more people to come forward. And who knows, maybe even the person he may have bought the test for might even come forward and say, you know, there was this guy I was seeing who just sort of disappeared, and mm-hmm. I always thought he walked out on me, or that my primary love interest might have had something to do with it, or whatever the case might be. I mean, this could just be just a random guy who was starting to wonder if maybe, you know, his girlfriend or wife or who knows was mm-hmm. potentially expecting a child, and the reasons behind getting that test, you know, have many different possibilities, I suppose. But yeah, you know, regardless, you know, this is a big break, and hopefully this will shed new light on his identity and, you know, who had, you know, the motivation to take his life.
Absolutely. And for those of you who missed that episode, you can actually just go back one episode, and it is my update on the Henry County John Doe. And in that episode, I do provide the phone number to the Henry County Sheriff's Office and how you can reach out to them, because if you know something, say something. That is the most important thing you can do. And with my other project, Suwannee Valley Unsolved, I've been preaching about Crime Stoppers. So go find their local Crime Stoppers hotline. Call it in if you know something. It's very important that you do, because this boy is missing a family. He's missing his name. I mean, and he deserves a proper headstone. And yeah, I mean, let's try to get this guy identified here. But on that note, though, there were some big identifications in the last, gosh, probably like the last 6 months. And it's been coming in like balls of fury.
Yeah.
and I can barely keep up with them because there's so many that happen in 1 month. Like, I used to be on top of this, but now I will admit, because of the many identifications that are taking place because of forensic genealogy or even, you know, your typical DNA test or fingerprints and dentals, but forensic genetic genealogy has been the breakthrough tool for most of these cold cases. And before we start talking about the big topic, because this is a case that was near and dear to Nick's heart, and it was a case that we covered in toward the end of our season two of True Cold Case Files. And so with that being said, we do have a special guest with us for this season two kickoff, because this case that we're about to be talking about here in just a moment was also very special to him. So special, in fact, that he continued for many, many years to revise these forensic reconstructions of this young woman and continued working toward hoping that her case would be solved someday. Now, I want to keep everybody in mind about this. Her case has not been solved. She's simply been identified. And now the investigation moves into the homicide investigation full force. So with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, I want everybody to welcome the great Carl Koppelman. Hey, Carl, how you doing?
All right. Thanks, Jason and Nick. Good to be here.
Yeah, we're glad to have you here. And like I was telling Nick before we hit the record button, that it would be important to have you on, because I know this was a very close case to you.
Yes, it was. I've been involved at some level since 2009, and since the Tammy Jo Alexander case in 2015 was resolved, I then went on to create this Facebook page for Walker County Jane Doe, and you know, started it up as just a Facebook page, and you know, it's come on to it's gotten millions, literally millions of clicks, and you know, ended up resulting in a Vice video and and a lot of publicity on the case. And
I know, like that. I was laughing so hard when the Vice crew, like, they took a video of you making a sandwich. I'm like, what?
Yeah, it's funny because I never eat at home, and I had to go run to the store. They said, "Oh, we need to film you making, you know, food." I went and got a bunch of English muffins and a box of eggs, and said, "Okay, well, I'll just make myself a ham sandwich or something." I don't ordinarily eat ham sandwiches at home, but I had to cook something on, you know, for the camera. So,
oh, I love it.
they needed B-roll. So,
I love it. I love it. Yeah. I mean, I was just like, holy cow. Like, they're really trying to make how they produced that video to make it very personal and not just.
We went up to Del Cerro Park, which happens to be a location where a John Doe was found in, I think it was 2001. Mm-hmm. There's in Palos Verdes up in, you know, up on the overlook to the Pacific Ocean there was, you know, that video ends with me walking through Del Cerro Park, which kind of has significance in the Doe world because there was a John Doe found at that park.
Yeah, absolutely. So with that being said, I want to let everybody know that if you missed it, if you've had your head in the sand this whole time, Walker County Jane Doe has been identified. And she has been identified as Sherry Ann Jarvis, who was only 14 years old. And, you know, that was one thing that I noticed, and I want to kind of get both of your opinions on this here, too. Are you shocked that she was 14?
I personally thought that right was right about where she was. The official age estimate was 15 and a half. And generally when you're dealing with that age segment that, you know, it's always give or take a year and a half. So, so she was at the low end of the, you know, right within range. If she was, you know, estimated to be 15 and a half, give or take a year and a half, then yeah, almost 15. She was a few months short of her 15th birthday. That was right about right. That's what I expected.
How about you, Nick?
So, and I know, I guess, and I think we even touched on this on the interview that I did with you a while back, Carl. I guess I kind of always, I didn't necessarily view her as, you know, being in her late teens. I sort of guessed it was, you know, no older than 16, maybe, you know, right. 15. I mean, obviously not that much of a difference, but I guess.
No, in my own mind, I had her about 15 or 16.
Yeah.
But, you know, knowing what the anthropologist had said was 15 and a half, give or take a year and a half. So, you know, they were right.
Sure.
Yeah.
Does it shock you guys to know that she was from Minnesota?
Oh, very much so. Minnesota would have been the last place on my list.
Yeah, I kind of had in my mind, you know, over the years, pretty obvious she probably wasn't anywhere near the place she grew up at, just based on the fact that they found, you know, no suitable matches from, you know, Rockport or Aaron's Pass. The fact that she was from Minnesota is just kind of a big surprise for me. Like my mom grew up in Minnesota in a pretty small town that was a couple hours north of where Sherry disappeared from. And I guess it's so strange. Sherry was born only a couple years after my mom was. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of interesting how that ended up turning out that way. I mean, I know when we were doing the research for the podcast episode on the case, I remember coming across this 1981 article saying that they were guessing she was, you know, could have been as old as 22. Then they kind of lowered the range again to, you know, 14 to 18. And then it was 15 to 20 for a while. So like she could have been born anywhere between, you know, 1960 and 1966. And it turns out that, you know, it was, you know, she was at the lowest end of the age range. And that is the case with a lot of adolescent victims.
But yeah. And it's something I mentioned earlier on my own page is that those photos, that one photo that's been bouncing around all over the internet of her was taken a couple of years before because her teeth. I know that her teeth were fully developed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that one photo has her, you know, right bicuspid still kind of
erupting.
And she knows she definitely had a very well aligned teeth by the time of her death. So
mm-hmm. on that note, and again, because I know how very close you two were to this case, and Carl, before I ask this question, did you get a photo of Sherry before they made the announcement?
No, I actually do have a photo of her after she left. When she sent the letter from Denver, she also sent a photo of herself, and I have that photo, but I can't put it out publicly. Mm-hmm. But it does show her teeth fully developed.
Okay, sure. So with that being said, when you guys first laid eyes on Sherry Jarvis, knowing for the last couple decades, y'all have seen this picture of this young woman who had been dead and beaten and strangled. I mean, this is the image that we've all grown accustomed to about this woman, or girl rather. And then suddenly, just this last week, y'all see a smiling girl with a name of Sherry Jarvis. What is your first thoughts on that?
Well, mine was, oh, that's her. There was no mistaking that face. Had I seen that even out of the context of a missing person, I would have said that's Walker County Jane Doe. I'm pretty confident that even without the benefit of knowing it was Walker County Jane Doe, I would have recognized her as such.
Yeah, I know with my perspective, as I watched the press conference live, and when they first revealed the photo of her, it was at a distance, so I couldn't quite, decipher that she was quite a bit younger when that photo was taken. But I remember seeing it, and I'm thinking, that really looks like her. And a couple of the other photos that they have released of her, it is, she is clearly at a younger age where you can tell she has not had, the orthodontic care that she's presumed to have received. But you can tell just based off of a lot of the photos of her, of course, in death, which were, they did distort her features quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But, with a lot of the artwork that was made, that kind of helped bridge the gap, I suppose. But I guess for me, what was really a big surprise was just, she's got this big, huge smile, these shining, vibrant hazel eyes. And
she had this smile that was never a closed teeth smile. It was always kind of a, an open mouth kind of. Mm-hmm. just a huge wide open mouth smile that was really captivating.
Yeah, and she had those dimples, and it was really, a lot of, because of, the nature of her death, how much suffering she went through, like there was no way to tell she had those beautiful big dimples. And
as a forensic artist, that's difficult. There's no way I could have, fashioned that smile of hers, the shape of that smile.
Yeah.
I mean, she appeared to have a slight underbite too that wasn't apparent in the postmortem photo.
And I will say this too, throughout the years that this case has been going on, we've had numerous facial reconstructions of her from Nick Mick, from you, Carl, from Karen T. Taylor. One of the most significant things that stood out to me when they released a picture of Sherry was that all along the artist had it right. Like, it just seems like, and I'm looking at some of the artwork that Nick was able to provide me with the notes, the hair is just strikingly remarkable in these artworks compared to the actual photo. It's almost
What's interesting is that photo that I just alluded to, her hair is a little bit thinner. It's not as you know, it's not as feathered as it was in that. I mean, that photo was kind of around the Farrah Fawcett days when everybody mm-hmm. had Farrah Fawcett hair.
Sure.
By 1980, your hair was a little bit thinner and a little bit lighter and a little straighter. But and actually, she more resembled my thumb out photo.
Yeah.
She looked yeah. happy. She looked, you know, she's had that same big wide open mouth smile and you know, it's very hard to conceive that somebody who's traveling around the country can be happy with what they're doing, but it seemed like she, you know, enjoyed traveling. So
yeah.
And I know one thing that really hit me hard is just, you know, to see how happy she looked, how big her smile was, how, mm. you know, just genuinely innocent.
Yeah.
You know, you get that impression from her photos. And a lot of the, you know, over time, you know, the various artwork that has been released from 1990 onward, you know, she's always been depicted as, you know, looking very stoic.
Mm-hmm.
The, you know, and as far as the witness statements too, you know, she's seems like she's almost, you know, a bit hardened, you know, obviously. I guess I didn't realize that. I know, Carl, you described that she was actually, she sounded almost a little kind of cocky and confident when
yeah,
she
that was
spoke.
What the waitress yeah. had said at the time that she spoke with that waitress, that she had come off with sort of a streetwise kind of a
yeah
you know kind of self-confident kind of air about her,
kind of mm-hmm. like that girl from Rocky when she tells Rocky, "Screw you, creepo."
Yeah.
No, but I mean, you know, it's kind of someone who, you know, has their head forward when they talk to you. And,
yeah,
you know, has their chin up, and you know, like
yeah,
and like, I guess, you know, you don't scare me, kind of a.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess too, like that, you know, description, that, you know, account of interacting with her, I guess that's maybe why I sort of figured she was a little bit older than she ended up being, because, you know, she kind of had this somewhat mature attitude, you know, way to, you know, carry herself that way. And, and too, I mean, I guess I'm not the best at necessarily telling somebody's age based on how they look.
And another thing I had mentioned earlier today on my page was, you know, there was a, right when I first started getting into the missing and identified, one of the very first cases that, you know, was being resolved at the time I got into it, was a girl named Bambi Dick. And she was known as Amarillo Jane Doe. She was found in Amarillo, Texas. Very similar circumstances to Sherry's case and to Orange Socks, in that she was also found naked on a road, on a major highway, in a culvert like Orange Socks was. This was 1983, so it was only a couple of years after Sherry's murder.
And she was
from Davenport, Iowa. She disappeared from Davenport, Iowa, from a rock concert, a Quiet Riot concert that she had been attending, and just disappeared after the concert was over, and somehow ended up 1,000 miles away in a culvert in Amarillo, Texas. Now that we know that, you know, Sherry was from Minnesota, which is only a state away from Iowa, you know, that may be something they might want to revisit.
Yeah. And I know, I had never heard of the Bambi Dick case until another user on Unidentified Wiki had added her file, and I read about her. And I guess even now, I never, you know, made that connection that, well, wait a minute, you know, she's from, you know, so far away and ended up in Texas.
And her family had no idea why mm-hmm. she would have gone to Texas or how she would have ended up in Texas either. Mm-hmm. It was just, you know, she went out to a rock concert one night and disappeared, and the next thing you know, she's dead in Texas.
Right. Yeah. So with that being said, though, Nick, you know, because this case has been very close to you, tell us a little bit more about what we were able to find out about Sherry Jarvis. I mean, her life after she ran away from Minnesota has been one big mystery up till now. What did we learn about this girl?
the details after her disappearance were pretty much unknown until now. I actually do have to say there's still, you know, a great mystery as to how she ended up in Texas, why she went to Texas. But, you know, what we do know now is that Sherry had been removed from her family's custody at the age of 13. She had missed too many days of school. And it was shortly after her birthday on March 9th, 1980, that she had run away from the state's custody. And it's a very sad thing that more than likely what triggered her to, you know, set off and take that journey of several months that resulted in her brutal murder. And her family described her as someone who absolutely loved children, who loved animals, horses. She was, you know, this typical all-American girl, as from what it sounds like. And it's just heartbreaking that her absence from school led her to being taken away from her family, who never saw her again. As what, you know, many of us suspected, is that when Sherry would have turned 18, her missing persons file was, you know, removed from the system. So, you know, there was nobody that could be compared to her. There were quite a few missing girls that disappeared around the same time that, you know, bore resemblance to her. And, you know, as Carl mentioned, Sherry had contacted her family, you know, during, you know, her time on the road.
With the statement that you're not going to hear from me until after I'm 18. So when they didn't hear from her, you know, for several years, it was looked at in that context. Okay, she said she wasn't going to contact us. And mm-hmm. So now the fact that she hasn't contacted us isn't, well, I mean, it's disturbing, but it's not like, oh, she must be dead. Let's go look mm-hmm. at unidentified bodies. It's, you know, she's mm-hmm. just, you know, looked at as if she's keeping her word that she's not going to contact us.
Yeah. And I think what a lot of people don't realize is, you know, following an identification of someone who, you know, does not appear in missing persons databases, they automatically assume that their family didn't care enough, they didn't do enough to, you know, put word out that their loved one was missing. Her family never stopped looking. They did hire right. private investigators.
And from what I've gathered from that family, they're very, you know, very, a whole lot. And they're, the family is a very loving family. They all, you know, love each other and all, you know, come from a very solid background. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's not, you know, they don't appear to be the types of people that would just say, oh, well, she's gone to hell with her.
Yeah. And I remember too, you know, the when Tammy Jo Alexander was identified, I remember even members of the police department. I recall one gentleman, you know, accusing them of not caring enough to report her missing. And then quickly they fire back and say, we did report her missing. The report just wasn't taken seriously because she had a history of running away.
And then there's a backstory to the Tammy mm-hmm. Alexander case too. Actually, she was in state custody as well. Mm-hmm. She disappeared. So, I mean, that was never really discussed publicly, but Tammy Jo Alexander had run away from a weekend furlough from state custody. So
exactly. And that is what I read too, is that, you know, it was not the family's responsibility legally to file that report. And I mean, it, you know, it does sound like that report was filed in Sherry's case, but, you know, because I'm assuming the fact that because it was purged from the system, she did have a history of mm-hmm. prior, you know, absences from, you know, where she had run away in the past.
There was a missing persons report filed. There was a, you know, a check on her social security mm-hmm. number. They had an alert for on her social security number. I mean, the family hired a private detective. I mean, what more can they do? There's no, they had no reason right. to believe she'd be in Texas. So
yeah,
Texas would have been the last place they would have looked. They were thinking she was in Colorado. So
sure. And that was something too, that was addressed in the Freddie Laster case, was that after he was identified by the Columbia County Sheriff's Office, a lot of people were wondering, well, why didn't his family report him missing? Well, get this, they did. And but the thing was because Freddie had been a habitual, you know, runaway, he would go off to mutual friend homes or he would go to another family member's house and stay there for months at a time. But when he didn't come back after 6 months, then they reported him missing. But here's a lot of the things that people don't understand about that process is that sometimes there's the question of, well, who do I report this missing person to? What jurisdiction do I report this person to? Do I report him to
Buckskin Girl with Marcia Sawson and Sting? She was an adult, first of all. So, you know, when her mother said left home and never came back, it's like, well, she's got a history of wandering.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
So they didn't even take a, you know, the mother attempted to file a missing persons report and they just said, oh, she's an adult. She has a right to be missing. But,
well, and that's ridiculous because Freddie was 16 years old when he went missing and then his torso subsequently found in Lake City. But another thing I'll tell people about, too, is that not only was there a jurisdictional issue in Freddie's case, but also he aged out of the system. So prior to, you know, modern legislation and stuff like that, once you turned 18, you were off the missing children's list. They kicked your ass out of NCIC. Mm-hmm. And then at that point, detectives aren't able to, you know, pinpoint, well, who does this body belong to? The only thing they have is a paper file back at headquarters. But the thing is, if law enforcement doesn't know that this missing person exists, then how do you put a dead body to a missing person in, you know, that doesn't have a file in NCIC? In
her case, she declared herself as voluntarily missing. She explicitly declared herself as such. So, you know, once she turned 18, it's like, well, now she's an adult. If she wants to be missing, she can be missing. That's not our problem anymore as far as, you know, law enforcement was concerned, other than the fact that she was a fugitive from state custody. But, you know, that was really low on their priority list, I guess.
Yeah. And I guess while we're talking about law enforcement, too, there is something that I do want to, you know, mention about the Walker County Sheriff's Office is that, you know, they were very tight-lipped about the investigation. I know for a long time they were even very hesitant to release all of the details about Sherry's murder, you know, especially the ferocity of the sexual assault that took place. So basically, the Texas-based company Othram, with the assistance from other agencies, were able to, you know, make the identification possible using genetic genealogy research. From my own, you know, conversations with David Mindelman, it was very tough for them to get usable samples. The DNA from the skeletal remains was not usable. It wasn't suitable to, you know, build this DNA profile that was.
Yeah, they'd already worked those bones, I think, a couple times before. So, you know, anything that was to be extracted from that had already been extracted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because she'd been in CODIS for, you know, so long and, you know, there were no hits. And then they ended up managing to get a usable file from, you know, brain tissue that was, you know, preserved, you know, from her autopsy. And that's how they were able to narrow down, you know, potential relatives and then, you know, forward that to law enforcement, who later found the link to the Jarvis family, who confirmed, yeah, Sherry's been missing since 1980 and we've never heard from her. And it's very remarkable how this is possible now for, you know, these unidentified individuals who, you know, without genetic genealogy, it's very unlikely they would ever be identified. So, I remember too, it was just very surreal, you know, thinking that I'm watching this live press conference right now where they're announcing that the closest Jane Doe case to my heart has been, you know, partially resolved with her identification, when I was starting to think it's been over 40 years. Is this ever going to get solved? And I just remember I was ugly crying during most of the press conference, and then for several I don't want to say hours, felt like hours afterwards, just because it was just incredibly emotional to finally see that, you know, she can finally rest with a name on her headstone. She doesn't have to be called Jane Doe anymore. And, you know, it's heartbreaking that both of her parents died before they could, you know, have answers yet. I mean, at the same time, as the family even mentioned, they were at least spared the horror of how violent her death was. And, you know, obviously with, you know, when you find out a long lost loved one is dead, there really isn't closure, as, you know, just like when there is a conviction in a murder case, there right. is no such thing as closure.
It always struck me how these cases seem to always be solved within a year or two after their parents pass away. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. and one of the things too, you also have to consider as well, is that they've been also spared the fact that her morgue photo is floating around still on the internet. And I highly doubt that those will ever go away. Those are there on the internet forever. And they're going to have to see that every time they type her name in.
Yeah. And Sherry's morgue photos are very unpleasant to look at. I think what always upset me was just how awkwardly positioned her mouth was. I'm glad at least her eyes were closed, but you know, it's not something you want to remember when you're dealing with the grief of losing your loved one after finding out she's been gone for the last 40 years. And it's a really sad thing.
Right. Sometimes you forget that, you know, mm-hmm. you've been looking at these things for years, and I've, you know, been kind of desensitized to the whole thing, and they don't generally bother me that much anymore, but you have to remember that family members aren't that desensitized to these things.
Exactly. And you know, and of course, you know, you've had your own you know, the instances where, you know, law enforcement have reached out to you and sent you this very deteriorated corpse that I think you were talking about the Donald Nyden case once, where been in the river for so long, and you know.
Oh yeah, well, I don't think that photo's ever been publicly released.
Yeah, but it's like, I mean, you've seen so much worse than I have, and I know Jason's.
No, that photo is a little shocking. I would never put it out in public, and there's no reason to.
I still have some of the crime scene photos from Freddie Laster's case, which are ultra violent, and I will never, ever, ever, ever put those on the internet. No one deserves to see those.
Yeah. And then to move back to Sherry, there are still a lot of unanswered questions about her disappearance. We don't know why and how she ended up in Texas. You know, it's been well documented for years that when she was seen alive on Halloween night, she was asking for directions to the Ellis unit, but there really have been no further developments on that, because
they did reaffirm, you know, in the press conference that it was the Ellis unit, not one of the others, you know, jail facilities. There's several jail facilities in Huntsville, so you know, that was always a question: are they sure it's the Ellis unit?
And right,
they reaffirmed that she did say the Ellis unit.
Yeah. And I guess another thing I did want to also touch on, what was really kind of interesting to me is, after they released the photos of Sherry, you know, you can tell there's this small, subtle kind of birthmark above her upper lip. And
I noticed that.
Yeah. And for the longest time, all of these, you know, descriptions of her just mentioned, you know, the scar that was near her eyebrow.
Mm-hmm.
And, I remember the morning the press conference took place, I was talking back and forth with Karen T. Taylor, and because we're friends on Facebook. She's actually a very, very social person, is what I've noticed. She's friends with a lot of people. She's a wonderful lady.
I met her in person. She's a delightful person.
Yeah. And I remember she was saying she was looking for her original rendering. She was having trouble finding it. She found like an empty folder, and then finally, with her husband's help, they were able to find the original sketch. I think it was, she said it was kind of in with some other images that she'd use for her workshops. And she was able to send me this high quality version of her original sketch, which is dated September 1990. And to the best of my knowledge, that's the first reconstruction that was ever made of her. Mm-hmm. And you can see, you know, there is that, you know, small birthmark in roughly the same location. And, you know, it's kind of surprising just because I know I never was able to make out any sort of mark when I was looking at her photos. And I just think that's really interesting that, you know, this was the very first rendering and that Karen noticed it.
I just zoomed in. Yeah, I just zoomed into the Karen Taylor sketch and holy cow, it's right there. I mean,
yeah.
Wow. Like, yeah, that's insane.
Yeah. And she's, you know, she is, you know, I guess
she's,
you know,
honestly.
Yeah. And she's, you know, she's been doing this for, you know, a very long time. And I think, you know, a lot of people generally like to kind of disregard the early sketches from especially that, you know, the 80s, the 70s, you know, some of them obviously, you know, could use revisions, but, you know, they're not just because they're, you know, done on a, you know, tracing paper or, you know, this old fashioned way, they can still be very credible and very accurate. I just think it's phenomenal. It really shows how, you know, observant and, you know, attentive she is.
Yeah. And I think also too, on that note, with the way that, like, with how battered her face was in the morgue photos.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it would be fair to say, you know, probably with other sketch artists, Carl included, that it was probably very difficult to even see that birthmark just considering mm-hmm. how battered her face was.
Yeah. And going through the different photos of her, you can't really see that. I don't know if it was photoshopped mm-hmm. out for some reason or because a lot of the lividity was photoshopped out in these photos mm-hmm. that are, you know, that are available online. So
and easily the birthmark could have also been mistaken as part of her injury too, had mm-hmm. it not been looking at closely. So like Carl said, there's a chance that they probably did Photoshop it by smoothing out the features. Mm-hmm. And
as you can see on this black and white, you know, the whole left side of her face is all photoshopped out because, you know, the unretouched one is, you know, it's all discolored from lividity.
And one thing I do want to also talk about, and I know we're kind of on the subject of all the artwork that we're talking about and the facial features, is that I noticed that despite all of the art that we've had over the years from Carl, from Nick Mick, from Karen Taylor, they decided to do another forensic art piece on this girl. And I wonder what was the purpose of this brand new piece of art? Was it because they wanted to highlight this scar that was on her eye, or was it just something to keep the case fresh? What were your thoughts?
Yeah, that was kind of strange that came out, but that was, I don't even know who they got to do that, but that came out. And then I think I did a couple more revisions of my own. And then once I did that quarter view turn image of mine, then the NCMEC went and revised the one they had done also. So
yeah,
you know, we've all been trying to revise our images, trying to improve upon. And as it turns out, that one I'm most pleased with, the one where she's standing in front of the front door to the diner.
Yeah.
You know, that one where she's just standing in front of the Hitch and Post truck stop diner door.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one turned out, I mean, at least in comparison to this image that's been floating around or that's most publicly seen.
Yeah. And, you know, I could definitely tell, like, with Nick Mack's 2015 revision that replaced the, I believe it was the 2012 version.
Yeah.
They definitely followed the, you know, the postmortem that was.
They used the same image I used.
I guess, so it was
the same angle, but.
Yeah, and I remember, you know, thinking that, you know, this is definitely, it looks more like her, you know, before, mm-hmm. you know, the intervention by the morticians. And I still remember when it was released, somebody was commenting on that, the Help ID Me page that posted the photo saying this girl just looks so haunted, and considering the details of her demise, you know, it's really, you know, it really kind of does show, you know, in that she looks very kind of,
it's telling,
timid and delicate, and that's why I think it was so, it was just so, you know, it hit me hard when, you know, the only photos of her that have been released, she's, you know, she's got that huge smile on her face, and, you know, she just has this completely different childlike, naive, you know, happy-go-lucky vibe going. And, you know, it really, you know, really hit me just how young and innocent she was, and that, you know, even though she was trying to portray herself as this self-confident, independent person, you know, I mean, she had been on the road for months. She'd, you know, probably hitched her way, you know, down the country and had made it that far. And in reality, she was a 14-year-old girl. And, you know, it's just really shocking just how somebody that young could end up facing such a horrific death.
You know, I'm just glad to hear that she's finally identified after so long, and, you know, being able to finally call her Sherry instead of Walker County Jane Doe. We just remember Walker County Jane Doe as a battered little girl who was killed in a ruthless attack. But now she's Sherry. And I think now with her photo of that big old smile, I think it's just awesome that we can now be able to call her Sherry and put that Walker County Jane Doe stuff kind of behind us and start focusing on who did this to this poor little girl who has been walking around hitchhiking all across America and only to end up dead in a mid-sized Texas town. Like, I think now we've got to focus on that part of the investigation. And like I said, you know, this year has been proving to be a great year for these unidentified cases. And I'm excited to see what the future holds for a lot more of them, especially when technology continues to advance. I'm all in for it. And I'm pretty stoked to see what the future holds in forensic science and in genetic genealogy and where all this goes. Like, I think pretty soon we're going to have a lot of Doe cases solved. And I think because of this new growing technology, Namus's unidentified collection is going to end up being trimmed like probably nearly in half by 10 years down the road, I think. I mean, what say you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, with DNA Doe Project, we've solved 70 of them now, or at least by my last count. I don't know what the exact count is now because it's constantly climbing. But but yeah, we continue to work these cases and continue to get new ones. So, you know, that Gacy case was one we had to keep quiet about for. We weren't even able to tell anyone that we were working it. So,
oh my word,
it's nice to see that one come.
Yeah, I did not see that coming. I was just like, holy shit.
Hey,
we broadcast there, you know, we say, oh, we're working this case, but you know, there are some that we work that we can't say anything about.
You know something, wasn't I the one that told you about that, Nick, about the Gacy case being identified? I sent that right straight to you.
I might have already seen the update on Facebook. I know I got the message from you at least. I mean, if I was aware of it beforehand, it was shortly afterward.
Right.
It was like, wow, holy crap, you know? So, yeah, I mean, I'm hoping that, you know, hey, maybe the other victims will finally, you know, get the justice they deserve, you know, to some extent. I mean,
yeah, I mean, you know, at least getting
tough.
Yeah. And at least getting their dignity back by getting their name restored, I think it is great. Mm-hmm. Is, you know, that's good enough for me in a way, but I know for the families, that's not good enough, you know. Some mm-hmm. of them want the justice. They want, you know, the peace of mind that they know who did this to their loved one. And I hope in the future that that Sherry's family does find out. And that way they can also rest knowing that, you know, justice has come to this guy, or at least they have the answers as to who killed mm-hmm. her. And I was talking to Detective Sergeant Jimmy Watson last week for an interview that I did with him, and he said it perfectly, that it's the not knowing that is probably the more painful for a family member than, you know, anything else in an unsolved homicide case. And I know this happened over 40 years ago, but just because it's 40 years ago or 4 days ago, the family is going to be thinking about this for a very long time, because especially now that they know that their loved one was murdered 40 years ago, it's going to weigh heavy on them for, you know, many, many years to come. So I hope that justice does come in Sherry Jarvis's case. On that note, we're going to go ahead and move forward with this episode, because I'm glad we were able to do a very huge profile on Sherry on this particular episode. And I know we run a little bit longer than we were anticipating, but that's always okay, because the people deserve to know everything about these cases. So I'm perfectly fine with that. So with that being said, we want to talk about season 2 of From the Vault. Now, Nick, I know we talked about this during season 1. We were going to continue it as season 1, but then we let many months pass us because both of us got really busy. Mm-hmm. And we just decided we're just going to go ahead and just start this off as season 2. I mean, how are you feeling about this, man? I mean, we're already in season 2 of From the Vault.
You know, I'm happy with, you know, everything that we were able to do. I wish I could have been more involved than I was, but, you know, as I've discussed in other, in a still unreleased episode, that, you know, it was a lot harder to really kind of stay on top of things. But I'm glad at least you were able to find people to fill in when I couldn't, be a part of the case discussions. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, we did the best we could. We did incredibly better than I think either of us anticipated for this, this new, brand that we came out with. And, you know, it's still, you know, the opportunities to continue with this is fantastic. And, you know, this is my passion, and I'm glad I finally have, you know, another platform where I can use my voice and you know, kind of learn and grow as a person on, mm-hmm. you know, my interviewing skills and my, you know, and with just, you know, communicating in general and learning how to sort of not stumble so much. And, you know, I feel like I've grown quite a bit since, you know, the first time you called me up to be a guest host on the Singer Island Jane Doe case several years back. So
yeah, absolutely. And yeah, you were like, I remember when Daisy and I spoke and we essentially parted ways, you know, I was like, I needed to find a new co-host. And I just remember our conversation in the Singer Island Jane Doe case. And I'm like, you know, he would actually be a perfect person to have on our cases, especially if we're going to be highlighting cold case missing children cases and John and Jane Doe cases, because I know that's kind of like in your area. So I was like, you were literally the first and only candidate for this position. And, you know, as we've worked together over the last couple years, you've definitely improved. And I've noticed that this growth in communication with media for you, like, you know, you've done a lot better since the beginning. I mean, you were still even good even at the beginning. It was just a lot more work to remove the ums and ahs.
Yeah. And I still feel that you know, is I was, you know, just before we started, I kind of revisited the interview I did with Carl. oh my gosh. I think there was one time where I said the phrase, you know, like many, many times in a row, and I'm just like cringing. It's like, oh my God, I can't believe I
said,
yeah.
I'm doing, you know.
Yeah.
Well, we always have that one episode, you know, where it's all bad.
But, you know, I mean, at least, you know, still like that, I'm still just grateful that I got to, you know, spend 4 hours, you know, digging into Carl's mind. And and that was just fantastic. And it was just, you know, it was so easy to just to have this discussion with them for so long.
And, yeah. And actually, you know,
I anticipate him on being as this long, but this one is, but.
Well, I'll also tell you this too. Carl is actually in a very rare place on From the Vault, because he is the first person who has actually returned for an episode. You know, it's like amazing. Like now, Carl is like now the torchbearer of that position. So
yeah, we'll give you a buzz, you know, in a couple of months, just before we're about to record an episode, Carl, if you want to
maintain your leader spot.
I got another 4 or 5 hours to
Yeah, absolutely. And it's always a pleasure having you on, Carl. I mean, it was great to have you on the first time, and I know I wasn't there for it, but I sure as hell was jealous, because I had been wanting to speak with you for a while too, but I just know that our schedules clashed a few times. So when with you guys speaking, I mean, hell, even with all the ums and you knows and all that stuff, it still was a good interview. And I really appreciated it. It was great and pretty informative. So there's that. I mean, but we always have that one episode where it's off. But we've grown from having no microphones to using Apple headphones to getting a $25 podcast mic, which I think was still pretty damn good for quality. Mm-hmm. And now here we are. We've grown to Samson condensed microphones, and I sound like I'm on the radio now. So it's great.
Yeah.
I mean, we've definitely grown as podcasters, and I think we'll do even more growing as this program goes along.
Absolutely.
So we want to kind of talk about season two. So there's going to be some changes to our lineup for season two. You know, season two is going to be a little bit different. We're going to have more episodes. We haven't really necessarily put together a set list, but we can definitely confirm two cases that we're going to be talking about. One of them is going to be Krista Harrison, which was going to be a case that we were going to close out season one with. But again, because of the time constraints that Nick and I did have, and we weren't able to podcast for a while, we're going to move that to sometime in season two. But our season opener, our opening case, is going to be a very unique one. It's not a Doe case. It's not a recent homicide, and it's not even a homicide from the 80s or the 70s or even the 60s. We go back to 1951. When we talk about the murder of Harry and Harriet Moore, it was an African-American couple who were murdered inside of their home in Seminole County, Florida, on December 25th, 1951. Yes, you heard me, Christmas Day. And this also just happened to be the 25th anniversary of their wedding as well. So, very tragic situation here. And for those of you who are real history buffs, this is going to be a very good episode for you, because essentially Harry Moore was one of the very first martyrs of the civil rights movement. And he was actually the first president of the Florida chapter of the NAACP. And another fun fact about Harry Moore, Nick, is he's actually just like me, from Suwanee County, Florida.
I'm definitely, you know, anticipating this is going to be a very emotional, a very powerful episode. And I think there's a lot of public interest. I'm definitely excited for this. I can tell that, you know, you're very interested and passionate about this, and that, you know, you have that, you know, that you know, location in common. And I think a lot of the public interest in these older cases, you know, like this one is, you know, pushing 70 years old as of today that we're recording,
mm-hmm.
that I think our listeners are going to be eager to hear what we have to say as well. So
yeah, absolutely. And the thing is that, you know, it still is long suspected that Harry and Harriet Moore were murdered by the Ku Klux Klan, as was pretty much common back in the day when it came to homicides involving African-American, you know, business leaders and activists and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can continue to talk about other homicides like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and Medgar Evers, and a lot of those, except for the Malcolm X case, a lot of those were tied back to white supremacists or the Ku Klux Klan. And this is no different, the Harry and Harriet Moore case. It's a very sad case because Harry's mother was also in the house, and so was his children when this bombing occurred. And it's just a very, very sad case. And it's a very tragic case, and it's been reopened a couple of times by the FBI, by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement as of recent. But the same conclusion draws back to the Ku Klux Klan. And this is going to be an episode that I think a lot of us will be intrigued by, just by, you know, based on the environment of the day, and then also getting a little bit of a history lesson as well. So, it should be a pretty damn good episode. And it's going to be amazing that, you know, with all the case collections we're doing. And also what I'm striving to do for season two is more interviews, where we can start making these episodes a little more personal by talking to family members. If we're, you know, dealing with missing and homicide cases, talking to the family members and seeing if they want to come and speak with us and, you know, just talk about things. And I know for a minute we were hoping to get Ray Tortillett's daughter on our program because we wanted to cover Ray's case, but we've still been waiting on a request, and also Taylor McAllister as well, and we're still waiting to hear from them. But I've allowed the option for them to just let us know when they're ready, and we'll cover the case, and we'll talk to you too. You just have to let us know when you're ready. So,
yep. And I also have to specify too that I do also want to point out that I still do hope to get the Kayla Berg case covered because, you know, I could, you know, I'm within driving distance. I actually was born in Anago, the same town where Kayla grew up, and my parents even actually knew the Bergs while we briefly lived in the city before moving when I was about 1.5. So I'm hoping that that'll be a possibility in the future as well. So,
yeah, absolutely. And I'd totally be down for that too. And I follow the Kayla Berg case too. In fact, I'm part of one of the online groups about her case, and it just seems like, you know, no one's really forgot about her. She's still talked about quite a bit in that area. Mm-hmm. So, and that's the biggest important part, is not forgetting about these cases. And that's what we do. That's why we do what we do, mm-hmm. because we don't want to forget them.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, but with that being said, I do want to kind of talk about something else here for just a second too, about season two. So we're going to be splitting season two up into season 2A, and then there's going to be a season 2B. Season 2A is going to involve me and Nick, and we're going to be talking about a few episodes of, or we're going to be talking about a few cases rather, of From the Vault. And these are going to be handpicked episodes once again, and we're going to be doing our homework on them, get some thorough information, that way we can get it out to you. But then season 2B is going to be a different story here, because one of the things that's going to be changing about this program is that as of season 2B, I will no longer be hosting From the Vault. And it's been a good run. I mean, I've enjoyed hosting this program and hosting True Cold Case Files. But then there's a time where, you know, you have to kind of balance everything out. because my day job, I'm a driver, I'm a truck driver, and I drive across the country. When I'm behind my laptop, I'm working on the next episode of From the Vault, or I'm working on my newer project, Suwannee Valley Unsolved. And sometimes you have to pick one or the other. And unfortunately, because of the time that is required for Suwannee Valley Unsolved, with the interviews, with the editing, putting it all together, I've got to actually shift my time to Suwannee Valley Unsolved just for a while, because it's requiring a lot of attention. But I will say this. This program is going to be in great hands with Nick. Nick has been an amazing co-host since I brought him on here, you know, a couple years ago. And he's learned quite a bit. So he's going to be hanging out here at From the Vault. But I will be replaced by my good friend Gwen Berenger. You may know that name. She helps John Lorden out with Seriously Mysterious, and she's also got her own program, A Light for Erica, which is about the missing persons case of Josephine County woman Erica Renee Hogue. And she's a great person. I love Gwen. She's an amazing co-host when I had her on for Joni Hall and Marjorie Luna, and I think she'll be a good addition. Wouldn't you think, Nick?
Absolutely. You know, I'm sad to see it go, of course. You know, I think we've got great chemistry, and, you know, we can really kind of just talk about absolutely anything, even when we're off the air, you know. And honestly, I'm forever going to be indebted to you for giving me this opportunity, and for, you know, just, you know, being here and putting up with, you know, a lot of the, they're the ums again, you know, kind of just winging it. Yeah. and having no formal training.
Sure.
And just from how much I've learned and how I've progressed, and, you know, I don't think I could ever really thank you enough for everything you've done, to help me with this and to give me a platform that I never thought I would have. So, it's bittersweet, but, you know, there's always a time where you gotta move on to bigger and better things. And,
Well, and, you know, well, and I'll put it this way too. I'm not going to be completely gone from the program, but I'll kind of explain what my new role is going to be here From the Vault. So, you know, I'm not going to be completely gone out of the picture. I'm not going to be behind the mic for a while on the show. And I might make appearances, but, for the most part, what's going to happen is I'm going to be actually producing the series from this point forward. Well, not from this point forward, but once season 2B starts, I will be producing those episodes, but I will not be hosting those episodes anymore. And Gwen and Nick will be taking the reins. And Gwen's got her own handpicked cases as well. And I think you guys will really enjoy that. And I've also given her permission to also showcase Erica Hogue's case as well. And I think that'll be a great case to dig into on From the Vault, especially considering, you know, Erica Hogue's case is very, very common, to be quite honest, you know, with missing women. But the thing is that, is law enforcement doing enough to handle, you know, missing adult cases? And I think, you know, throughout our conversation tonight, Nick and Carl, we kind of did touch up on that, about how, you know, with missing adult cases, sometimes law enforcement might not necessarily look super close at them, because, again, they can be missing on their own free will if they want. They can just go missing and, you know, that's their choice. But sometimes they overlook the bigger picture on these things. And I think that's what's happened with Erica Hogue. But yeah, and I do kind of also want to explain this new project that I'm doing too. It's called Suwannee Valley Unsolved. And the Facebook page is already up. You can check it out now. I'm going to be talking about local cases that are in Suwannee, Columbia, and Hamilton counties in Florida. And I'm going to be opening up that season discussing three separate cases involving store robbery homicides. The first case I'm going to be talking about is the 1971 homicide of Mark Brotherton, who was killed in a gas station in Lake City. Now, the cool thing about that case was I was able to actually track down the other guy who was also shot in the store, and he sat down for an interview with me. And that was one crazy interview, and I think y'all will be very shocked when y'all hear this. So that was a really good interview, and I was able to really get the stories built in each case. So there was Mark Brotherton. 1989 was a woman named Darlene Messer who was abducted from the Suwanee Swifty store, convenience store. Nick, you're familiar with that case, aren't you?
Yes, and I know we've talked about that too, as I think you were going through the process of writing the episode and recording it, and I think that's definitely an important case to touch on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I mean, she was abducted. You got to think about that too, and that's not necessarily common. You know, she was abducted from this gas station, and then 2 days later found in a neighboring county. And I know there were other missing women's cases right around that time in Florida, like Deborah Poe. Then after that, you know, things kind of got forgotten. You know, well, people kind of forgot about her case after that. But also a lot of people don't realize that wasn't the first abduction at a place of business. The previous one prior to Darlene's was that of an agriculture inspector named Dewey Gay, who was kidnapped from his inspection booth by drug smugglers. And he was stripped of his uniform and his service weapon and dumped on a farm in Brooks County, Georgia, shot to death. And it's just insane when you really start digging into the darkness of where you live. You learn a lot of dark shit. And then finally, we'll be talking about Linda Rollerson, who was also murdered in 2008 at the Joy America food store. And First Coast News just did a special on that case, and I was very pleased with the result on that. But as you probably hear, that's a big-ass project that I'm working on, so bear with me on that. But in the meantime, I'll still be here at From the Vault, and then a few episodes down the line, Gwen will be taking over.
And I guess to add to that, you know, exploring the darkness of your own hometown, I also, that reminded me, just recently, the local news media has started to draw attention to these unsolved doe cases right here in Rhinelander, Wisconsin, where I live and where I grew up. And for the longest time, I only knew of this man who was found in Harshaw back in 2007, or excuse me, of a gentleman who was found in the year 2000 in Harshaw, which is very close to the area. It's within the county. And then, you know, a couple of years ago, they added the 1980 Rhinelander John Doe case to Namus, which really caught me off guard, because I had no idea that that was, you know, a case at all. And it turns out that there are approximately 11 unidentified individuals, you know, found in the area, you know, over the last, you know, I would say probably 70 some years. They just added a young woman. Actually, I don't know if she was necessarily a young woman, but they added a new case from the area from 1947. That is in Namus now, and I'm anticipating them to be adding more soon. So it's really fascinating, because I never would have guessed in all my years, you know, of researching that there would be that many cases in this little town with, you know, a population of just under 8,000.
Oh yeah, you would be very surprised. 1947, man. That's actually, and that's the thing that I keep saying. I wouldn't be surprised if there are unsolved cases that go before Mark Brotherton's case, because, you know, as of right now, he's considered the coldest case in my area. But I wouldn't be shocked if there's other unsolved cases that haven't been found yet.
Absolutely.
So, and especially like with your area too, like there's probably cases that haven't been touched in a very long time that are just waiting to be opened and looked at. So, and someone once told me there's not an expiration time on homicide. So exactly. We can still find answers. It's just a matter of what do we have for evidence and what are the facts. So
exactly.
But yeah, other than that, I mean, that's pretty much all the changes that we've got going on right now for season two of From the Vault. We're still rolling. We're still going to be telling you all about different cases throughout the country and also in Canada. And we're going to be, yeah, we're just going to keep working at it. So, yeah. So, I mean, I'm pretty stoked about it, aren't you?
Most definitely. It's going to be a very interesting season for you, for me, for Gwen. And it's going to be a big change, but, you know, we'll get used to it. We'll roll with it. And I'm sure it's going to go great.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. But like I said, it's been great being right back behind the microphone and chatting with you and chatting with Carl and having Carl back on. I mean, it's been a great episode to open up our season. And Carl, we appreciate you coming back on at the last second too. Like, I mean, we caught you at a good time, didn't we?
Well, yeah. I mean, I've just been sitting around here doing research on our Bender of Jane Doe case. So, you know, I can do that and listen to the conversation or take part in the conversation at the same time. It's
yeah. Hey, that's awesome.
Yeah. And it's such an honor to, I mean, just, you know, even though we're all in different places of the country right now, it's just an absolute honor to be, you know, having a conversation with you in the moment, you know, especially with your your fame, I guess, you know, as we touched on.
Okay, great to be on the show.
Absolutely. And Nick, again, it was great chatting with you and opening up season two. And yeah, I'm definitely hoping it'll be a good season.
Yeah, me too. And yeah, like you said, you know, it's a great feeling to be, you know, back behind the microphone and talking about what we love. So
Exactly. But with that being said, folks, we're going to go ahead and close out this episode of From the Vault. It's been great to be back on the microphone and having a fresh episode for everybody, because I know some of y'all were probably wondering, where the hell is Jason and Nick? Well, we've been here this whole time, but we've just been fucking busy. So, anyways, everybody, thank you all for joining us. Nick, thank you so much again for joining me. Carl, happy to have you on.
Bye, everyone.
All right, all. Y'all have a good one, and we'll see you on the next episode of From the Vault.